a friend of mine called me about a pastor of some kind that she had watched a video on. And morning. And of course, this guy purported to know the sovereignty of God, and he was making a video about the sovereignty of God. But his idea of the sovereignty of God was that God is so powerful that he can actually, are you ready for this? He can actually redirect people. If he sees that somebody is going off the rails, somebody is going afoul of his plans, he's so powerful, he can arrange circumstances to turn them around and head them back on the right path again that will cause his ultimate will to be accomplished. But my friends, that is not a sovereign God. That is a God who adjusts to what he sees human beings doing. It's a God who tries to make the best out of situations that nearly get out of his control. It's a nice way of saying that, oh, God is sovereign, but he's not sovereign at the same time. But I want to give you the true definition of the sovereignty of God. And really, what I'm about to tell you about God's practical operations is a great example of the absolute and the relative. When we see God changing course, when we see people, when we see people changing course, we see people changing their minds, we see people going from bad things they're doing to good things that they're doing, we can rightly say, well, God changed that person's life. Yes, indeed, that's true. But it accords with the relative, not the absolute viewpoint. Because, again, the relative viewpoint shows us relations, people relating to other people and to circumstances. So as we look at them, they're changing. As they relate to their circumstances, they decide to do something instead of something else. But above all this, the knowledge of the truth, and this is the knowledge that we have, is that God all along planned beforehand what would happen, and the people walking it out on earth are just now seeing it. They're just now realizing what God eons ago determined beforehand to occur. A great verse along this line showing both the absolute and the relative would be Philippians 2, 12 and 13. I alluded to it either yesterday or the day before, but here is both perspectives in one verse. And boy, the free will people love the first part of this verse. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And that's, they stop there. That's verse 12. They don't get to verse 13 because verse 13 throws everything off for them. And see, this isn't a mutually exclusive thing. You don't have to believe the absolute viewpoint at the expense of the relative viewpoint and vice versa. So the second part of that passage, let's read the whole thing. And this time I'm going to read verse 12 and verse 13. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your own salvation, I believe it says, even in the concordant version. For it is God operating in you to will and to work for the sake of his delight. It's God that is operating in you. That's the absolute viewpoint. So even as you're working out your own salvation, you have the knowledge, or at least you should have, and I think my viewers today have, you have the knowledge that no one can do anything except God is working through them to do it. Before I get to Paul, I told you I was going to give you an example of Paul believing in the absolute but living as he must in the relative. I want to make sure you understand that first thing I told you about the pastor who supposedly believed in the sovereignty of God. It only appears to us that God makes adjustments. This is only half of the thing. It's only looking at what we see. That is, it's only considering the relative and not looking at the absolute. Because absolutely, there are no missed decisions. There are no guesses. God does not give, as I've heard, God does not give human beings a certain degree of freedom. This is a famous phrase. Many people who want to have their cake and eat it too, believe in the sovereignty of God and believe in human free will. They want to say that, they like to say that God is sovereign, but he's really not. You know, he gives you a short leash. The analogies given here is either a dog on a leash or a fly in the jar, that God has gives you a certain amount of freedom, and then when it looks like you're going to make a run for the edge of the jar, or it looks like you're going to break the leash, then God intervenes at that point. Well, my friends, there is no point at which God intervenes. There is no point at which our free will ends and God's sovereignty begins. The only difference here is a difference between viewpoints, the absolute and the relative viewpoints. It appears as though people are making decisions. Wow, look at that. I saw a guy change his mind from doing a wicked thing to doing a good thing. He decided not to drink anymore, not to smoke anymore. Now he's free. Wow, he pulled himself out. No, he didn't. It's God put him in the mess in order for God to get him out of the mess. There is no such thing as a fly in a jar or a dog on the leash. These are human inventions. These are analogies invented by human beings. Why? Because human beings hate God's analogy. God's analogy for the way, and you would think that for such an important thing as the sovereignty of God, you would think that God would give us an illustration in the scripture of how he relates to human beings. And indeed, God does. It's in Romans chapter 9. It's called the potter and the clay. There it is. Simple analogy. But guess what? People don't like that analogy. They hate it. Because they don't like the humility of being called a piece of clay. They don't like it. It's so funny. Whenever people hear me teach on the sovereignty of God, they like to say, Martin, you're just saying that we're robots. Is that what you're saying, Martin, that we're just robots? I said, oh, no, God, did you think I called you a robot? I'm sorry. No, it's not that at all. I said, you're giving yourself too much credit. You're not a robot. Robots blink. Robots move. Robots can operate at a distance from their operators. No, I didn't mean to say we're robots. I meant to say you're clay. It's worse than a robot. Absolutely worse than a robot. You're clay. Clay is humiliating. You're giving yourself too much credit to say you're a robot. Sorry about your luck, but you know what? Once you learn this truth, then honestly, things are going to go a lot better for you. It gives you peace to know. We have the best of both worlds in this department because God lets us be. He lets us be. He gives us the gift of ignorance. So we're ignorant about what's going to happen in the next minute. So we live as though it all depends on us. That's exciting. Yeah, we all love, it feels like we have free will, doesn't it? It feels like it, but you really don't. You know, you work out your own salvation. Yeah, that's fun. I'm going to show you with Paul. Yeah, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. Yeah, it's like a big football game, and it's like, what's going to happen next? Fourth quarter, 2-minute warning. Who's going to win the game? Yeah, that's exciting. We like to live that way, and God lets us live that way. It's called the bubble of ignorance. We don't know what's going to happen next. So we live like as though we have free will before something happens, and then we have this glorious thing called the knowledge of the absolute, that God is operating all in accord with the counsel of his will, and that God is operating in us to will and to work. So after you do something, you can shrug and say, that had to happen. But before you do something, you don't say that. Well, whatever I do has to happen. No, you're in the game because you're ignorant of what's going to happen next by the design of God, and so you do the best you can. We all do the best we can based on circumstances. Who's in charge of all the circumstances? God? Yeah. I really don't think these people behind me in the cemetery would mind too much that I'm bringing this epic truth to you from in front of their tombs. I think when they find out what I've done here, and they will, they'll be happy about it. In fact, I used to walk through this cemetery last year, and I asked God to give me all these people at the Great White Throne. You know, we're going to judge messengers, we're going to judge angels, and we're going to be in Christed, and we're going to be not only part of the judgment at the Great White Throne, but we're going to execute judgment at the Great White Throne. And these are my fellow Floridians here, all of whom have assumed room temperature. And so I ask God to let me have them. And I can't wait to be a source of grace and blessing and wisdom and knowledge and realization to them at the Great White Throne. So we have Paul in Acts chapter 27, and he's on a ship bound for Rome to testify to the truth before kings. Actually, the Romans saved him from the Jews. How ironic is that? And he's on his way to Rome, and as you know, Paul is on a ship, and this ship experiences a shipwreck, and they have to winter on an island, and it's a mess. It was a hurricane wind, basically. I'm in Acts chapter 27. You can read all about it, starting with verse 14. A wind, a hurricane called a northeaster, casts itself against the island, the ship being gripped by it. You can read all the nautical details. It's a nautical nightmare happening here to Paul. You can read all that in Acts 27, starting in verse 14. Okay, so Paul has to address the mariners. The mariners are getting ready to throw things off the ship, and they're very superstitious, these Romans, so they're not taking food. They're assuming that their gods will be pleased if they don't eat anything. And so Paul says, no, you must not do this. You've been abstinent, you've been not eating stuff, that's crazy. Here, have a sandwich. And then Paul, standing in the midst of them, says this, verse 21. It was binding upon you indeed, O men, yielding to me, not to have set out from Crete. So Paul, being an expert mariner, apparently told them, don't set out from Crete. I would have said the same thing. But they did, and that's what got them into trouble. So Paul's kind of giving them the what for. I told you not to set out from Crete. But what did you do? You set out from Crete. And they got stuck in a hurricane. But now I am exhorting you, Paul says, to be cheerful, for not one soul from among you will be cast away more than the ship. In other words, the ship's gone, but every soul on this boat, 276, I believe, will be saved. And they probably would have said, you sound pretty confident, Paul. How do you know that? Listen to what Paul says. For there stood beside me this night a messenger of God, whose I am, to whom I am offering divine service. Also saying, fear not, Paul, before Caesar you must stand. And lo, graciously has God granted you all those who are sailing with you. He has graciously granted, God has every single soul sailing with you. That's a fact. Wherefore, be cheerful, men. I am believing God. Remember I told you we believe in the absolute. We believe it, but we act and live in the relative. I'm believing God, Paul said, and thus it will be. Thus it will be. God has spoken, and thus it will be. God has said that no one on this ship will be lost. That's a fact. It can't not happen. Therefore, eat this sandwich. You still shouldn't have set out from Crete. But, okay. Now, as the 14th hour came, verse 27, at our cruising about in the Adria, in the middle of the night, the mariners suspected some country to be nearing them. And sounding, they found 20 fathoms. It's getting shallow. And after a bit of an interval, sounding again, they found 15 fathoms. Besides fearing lest somewhere we should be falling on rough places, this is Luke writing, Luke is here, pitching four anchors out of the stern, they wished for the coming of day. Yeah, I would too. Now, at the mariners seeking to flee out of the ship, here's the key, listen to this, verse 30. At the mariners seeking to flee out of the ship and lowering the skiff into the sea under pretense of being about to stretch anchors out of the prow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, quote, verse 31, if ever these should not be remaining in the ship, you cannot be saved. If you don't remain in the ship, you cannot be saved. This appears to be a contradiction. What Paul is telling these mariners is, if you try to save yourself by lowering people onto the sea in these skiffs, you're going to die. You can't be saved. Now, this is interesting because the messenger of the Lord told Paul that everybody's going to be saved. That was a guaranteed fact. Everybody's going to be saved. So theoretically, now Paul could have just sat in the bottom of the boat, not done anything, and he knew, he would know beyond a shadow of a doubt, because the Lord told him that everyone would be saved. Yet Paul is a mariner, and he lives in the relative, and he believes in the absolute, but he lives in the relative, and he sees these people lowering a skiff onto the sea, and he's like, these people are nuts. If you do that, you're going to die. Unless you stay on the ship, you can't be saved. That's true. How can that be true and God predetermined their salvation? It's this way. Both are true. One's the absolute viewpoint, one's the relative viewpoint. God did decree ahead of time that everyone would be saved. But belonging to that, a part of that happening was Paul being out there, being the mariner that he is, being the pain in the ass that he is, saying, hey, you idiots, unless you stay on the ship, you can't be saved. Which was also true in a relative sense, because Paul lives in a relative world, as we all do. So Paul is not contradicting himself. It's true that if they didn't stay on the ship, they would not be saved. It's also true, God said everybody was going to be saved. Everybody staying on the ship, instead of lowering the skiffs, belonged to, was part of God's way of making the absolute happen. And Paul in that moment might have been unconscious of it. You know, he might have forgotten what the Lord has said, absolutely. That's fine. I like to say we put the absolute truth in our back pocket and we live in the relative. We put the absolute truth in our back pocket. We know it. And yet we have the excitement, the drama, the interest of living as though it all depends on us. It doesn't. But in the mercy of God, he makes it seem that way. Otherwise, life would be kind of boring. I love my country. Don't you love your country? Some people think they're maybe too celestial or too cool to love their country. But I ask you this, do you love your family? Are you proud of your hometown? Do you have some kind of affection for the state you live in? Doesn't mean we don't long for our celestial home. It just means we're human and we have affections. And I do love that flag. Too cool for school, are you?